whatever. These are typically conserved quantities in nature, and you can actually write down conservation laws for these quantities. And also, I mean, we'll be actually focusing on the Euler equations, the hydrodynamic equations, and also the MHD equations. And the hydrodynamic equations can be used to solve a myriad number of problems, like weather, ocean waves, the gas in this room, acceleration of bullets down chambers, jet engines. It's just a really powerful tool, and it's fun to, you know, you could set up a toy problem on your computer and see what happens. You know, you say, well, okay, let me write my name and have that as a boundary condition, and let's flow fluid past it and see what kind of turbulence we get past this strange boundary. I mean, it's just really fun stuff, and I don't know. So I don't know. When I learned the methods, I felt really empowered that I could do so much now. And you get beautiful pictures out of this too. So I kind of have a little artistic side, and I'm one reason why I'm in this field is to actually make pretty pictures and pretty simulations. So so you get that benefit out of it too. So anyway, so let's get down to it. So the conservation equations typically have this form. The right hand side is usually not a function of the derivatives of Q, the conserved density, okay? And so the principal part is still that of a hyperbolic system. And so we'll be taking the finite volume approach, where, and we'll be looking at only the one-dimensional problem. So we consider this space-time volume, which is on the board of an area. So we consider the discrete element from t sub n, or t sub n, to tn plus 1. Okay, so this is one time step indexed by n, and then this is the next one. And then we start from xi minus 1/2 and go to xi plus 1/2. Note this is such that we start our counting at the cell center, okay? It's the middle of the cell domain. So for instance, delta t is equal to t sub n plus 1 minus t sub n. Delta x is equal to xi plus 1/2 minus xi minus 1/2. Okay. So we found that if we essentially integrate this equation, or we start with the integral form of the conservation laws, that we get something like this. And I wrote really big. I don't know how good the camera is. So. And then the right-hand side is just the double integral of psi. Okay. Bounds are obvious. So what we do is then, we recognize that this is the amount of the conserved stuff, like mass, for instance. And so we label this Q bar, okay. And so now we have, Q bar is actually the volume average, okay. So let's keep the time derivative, the time integral. So since where since Q bar is the time or the volume average, let me write this here. And we'll define a, so this is the volume cell volume average, and we'll define a numerical flux, capital F, to be the time average of the flux over one of the cell faces from Tn to Tn plus 1. And we'll define a value of this space time average of psi to be this. And you can show that, I won't go through all the dirty details, but you can show that. You can put this equation into this form. If you're familiar with finite difference equations, which probably should be from last week's project, you can see that this strongly resembles such an equation. So this looks like a spatial derivative of the fluxes. So you know, it's similar to the original equation. And this is like an update equation. So we're updating Q from n to n plus 1. And however, we're kind of using the integral forms of these quantities, not their continuum values. So, yes?
And where do we have phi I for n plus 1 half?
Oh, yeah. So actually, also the fluxes are nominally defined at n plus 1 half because they're time averages over this space. So you can think of qi living here, qin, and qi n plus 1 living here. And then the fluxes will live here. However, you can then cast this setup into this form, into a typical, you can generalize this to a general update equation.
So this
I'm sorry. Well, I didn't define a T. Yes, you're right. Thank you. So this resembles something like uh, like an ODE like this, right? You're integrating Q and time, and this L, this stuff is just right hand side of this integration. And so this is just an ODE, so you can essentially just use any ODE integrator to update Q, given, assuming that you know how to update F, how you can calculate F. So for the newcomers, I just want to say that we started talking about fluid dynamics and the numerical solution of the fluid dynamics equations, and they take conservation law form. And so these methods can be applied to any conservation law, but we'll be later focusing on hydrodynamics. So. And so today I hope to finish the algorithm part of it, but we'll see. So typically what people do is they use method of lines. So that this is essentially what I'm describing to you is the act of breaking this setup down into a right-hand side that we use to integrate the time Q equation, the Q dot equation, is the method of lines. That we break it down into we first solve the spatial part, and then we step in time. Okay. And there are a number of, I'll write it down, method of lines. Or mole. And this method, the method of assuming a piece, we've now turned a continuum field equation into a discrete equation where we have cells, cells of piecewise constant data. So if we define the cell boundaries here and we plot, so this is x and this is q. So let's say this cell has this value of q. Qi minus 1. Qi is a little bit higher. And Qi plus 1 is a little bit lower. So remember, these are cell averages. So they represent the value of the represent Q throughout that cell. So it's just a set of piecewise constant data now. And this way of solving the equations is called Gonnod's method. And so there's a whole class of numerical techniques called Gonnod techniques, or Gonnod style techniques, or whatever. Yes. So going back to the method of lines, so there are example. There are typical mole integrators. Or really ODE integrators. So there's Runge-Kutta. I may not be pronouncing that name right. That's how I've always pronounced it and how people around me pronounce it, but I've heard a few variants. So you can do, there are several orders of accuracy versions of Runge-Kutta. We'll be actually using the second order, which is also called the half-step method, where we start with a Tn step, we jump to the Tn plus 1 step, calculate Q, this gives us Qn plus 1 half, which is used to define f of n plus 1 half, which is just f of q n plus 1 half. Okay. And then using this, we can then do the full step and use this equation, essentially. Okay. So essentially, the first step, qn plus 1 half, is equal to qn minus delta t over 2 L of qn. Okay. And then knowing qn plus 1 half, we stick it into the right-hand side and then use this equation to give us the full step. Okay, then there are also these predictor-corrector methods. And Euler's method is one, but we won't be using it. It's just a let you know. How we handle psi. So the rest of the lecture will be essentially dealing with how we calculate L, how we calculate the right-hand side. Because think about it, it's a little tricky because it's a time average of a flux that we really don't know how it, I mean, we're trying to calculate how Q evolves. F is a function of Q, so how do we know what the time average of F is, right? So so it requires some sophistication, and we'll get to that. But before I do, I just want to say how we calculate psi usually. Remember, psi is this space-time volume average. And what we typically do is we cop out, and we approximate it as just the half step value psi using q at this half step value. So you can prove to yourself that this is second order accurate. So this is a kind of a finite difference approximation to this finite volume quantity, and you can show that finite volume techniques reduce to finite difference techniques to within second order accuracy. So second order accuracy in the fact that, so if you have Q, let me just not write this down willy-nilly on the board here. So if you have a finite difference solution Q and you subtract it by a finite volume solution at the same time and spatial point, then this will be those two solutions will be the same to order delta x squared, you know, plus order delta t squared. Okay, so it'll be some term proportional to delta x squared, delta t squared. So if you keep on increasing the resolution or shrinking delta x and delta t, then you'll converge to the same solution. That is, of course, if you don't have shocks present in your solution. And we'll talk more about shocks. So how do we calculate this numerical flux function f? Okay, so we call this the numerical flux. And I'll probably be calling this Q, just plain old Q, not necessarily the cell average. It'll just save me some labor. Anyone have any questions right now? Am I going fast or slow enough or good? All right. Okay, so first, let's look at this. Okay, so we've got these barriers, essentially, at an instant of time, separating these different discrete values of Q. So imagine you have, let's imagine we have this tube. Okay, we have this tube. Right. Actually, is everyone done with this stuff? So I want to get a back ache. Okay, so consider a fluid-filled tube. And imagine that in the middle of this tube, there is a barrier. Okay. And so, you know, we have this tube, it's real. We have this barrier. We can actually pull on this barrier, and then the fluid will flow through the tube. Okay, so we have some right state, QR. Ah, wow, there's an impressive dyslexic moment there. So you have a left state, QL, and then you have a right state, QR. Okay, so for instance, in real life, you would have gas of different density or different pressure on each side of this barrier. Okay, so imagine you had gas of different pressure. Let's say there's low pressure here and high pressure here. You remove the barrier. What do you think would happen?
The pressure goes to equilibrium.
Okay. Okay. So and you know that the pressure on an area is a force, right? So the pressure differential. So you're going from high to low, right? So probably. This fluid would flow generally in the leftward direction. Right? So this problem is very similar to what we have here, right? So we have barriers separating different values of Q. So if you plotted Q, along this tube, you would have, in my example, I had it like this. So we have QI minus 1 and QI, or QL and QR. Okay, so this is called the shock tube problem because people set up these tubes to study shocks. They used something transparent for the tube, and they used high-speed photography to actually capture the flow of the fluid. And this is how fluid dynamics was done back in the day. You can still, typical fluid dynamics books actually have photos of these tubes, and it's really, really kind of neat. So, in general, though, from a mathematical point of view, this is called the Riemann problem. So, the Riemann problem is one where you have two distinct states, and the entire fluid is described by some conservation law. Okay, that's the classic Riemann problem, that your initial state consists of two discrete states, QL and QR, for x less than 0 and x greater than 0. Okay. The Riemann problem is, okay, so we have these two distinct states. We have the conservation law. How does it evolve in time? Okay, that's the problem. What does Q of x of t look like? And essentially, it just depends on the ratio of the two states. Okay, as we said, the pressure is higher on this right side than it should go to the left, right? It should push back. Let's take Berger's equation as an example. So we have, I'm sorry, it's different. F of q is equal to q squared over 2. So that means that del TQ plus Q del XQ, not GQ, 0. Okay. So this is the initial condition. This is the evolution equation that we want to solve. Can I erase this stuff? It's pretty much in the notes, so. So the first case, so when we have QL is greater than QR, okay, which wasn't what we considered in that diagram, but looks like this. So we start off with a discontinuity, which is bigger on the left than on the right. And what happens is that the solution at a later time looks like this dash curve. Okay, this discontinuity just moves to the right. You can through inspection you can see that from Herger's equation. Okay, Q is positive, so something that has a negative gradient in x will want to move to the right. Okay. So the solution. Or, I'm sorry, I said, yeah, a second. There. So the solution is really just QL and QR, but just shifted. So for so it's QL for x less than ST and QR for x greater than ST. And ST is the speed at which this shock moves. Yes?
So you're doing a simple Riemann problem?
Yes.
And
or is this a Riemann solution?
This, yeah, so that is like the solution for which equation or for both?
So this is the general equation, and Berger's is when f of q is q squared over 2. And so when you plug in f, it becomes this equation. It's kind of messy. So if you look at the characteristic structure of this, or the space-time diagram of the characteristics, you have the shock moving along this diagonal. The right-hand, the state on the right-hand side has slower characteristics. These are meant to be parallel lines. And on the left side, they're faster characteristics. That's why they pile up and form this shock. So you can see that the shock is just the face of this discontinuity. Okay. It's the boundary between the left and right states. And the shock moves at the speed s, which we'll determine right now. And it's also where the characteristics merge. So if you have characteristics of your system that collide, you know that shock is formed. Yes?
What is
it can describe lots of things in nature. Here we're taking kind of a mathematical approach so that we can become familiar with the methods. But for instance, yesterday we used mass density as an example. And so the conserved quantity would be mass. So in our case, we want to study relativistic hydrodynamics. So we want to solve the local conservation of energy equate of energy. And we also want to solve the continuity equation. Can everyone see that? I'm sorry. So this is the local equation of conservation of energy. So everyone's familiar with NABLA, right? So, okay. This continuity equation just means that you know mass is conserved. Mass is just moved around. Okay. Rho is the mass, rest mass density, and U is the four velocity. T mu nu is the stress energy tensor. Okay, so you can see that if you expand this out into time and space components, it looks like a conservation law. Okay, so in this case, this is just like our conservation of mass example yesterday. And this will be where energy and momenta are conserved. In terms of the MHD equations, you would have conservation of flux, essentially, that you would be evolving. So how do we calculate S? S is derived from the Rankine-Hugoniot relationship. Also, I could be mangling their names. So that says that if you given any jump in your value q, f of qr minus f ql is equal to the sound speed the shock speed times the size of the discontinuity. And in general, this is a vector equation. Right? F and Q are state vectors. It could be pressure, density, energy, sort of thing. So in general, this has four components. So that's the four momenta of your fluid. So if you think in terms of special relativity, the time component would be your energy density, and then the spatial components would be your momenta. And they'd be all coupled too. Okay, so this becomes really difficult to solve in when you have multiple equations. Okay, so this is the classical solution. This is the simple solution. The more difficult solution is when you have the reverse, QR greater than QL. And if you remember yesterday, we talked about the inviscid limit of the viscous equations. So we said that nature is viscous, but most of our problems involve very little viscosity. And so we typically just assume the viscosity is zero and solve those equations because it's much simpler to do. However, the inviscid equations give rise to these characteristics and shocks that are not analytic. And so we have to use weak solutions of the equations or entropy condition preserving solutions. So case two, we have QL. Is less than QR. So our setup looks like this. And one solution would be that this just keeps on moving to the right. And the characteristics would look like this. So we would have the same shock speed. The characteristics would look different. They'd look funny. And if you did solve the viscous equations and shrunk the viscosity to zero, or even if you added just a little bit of viscosity to this system, this solution, it would be unstable. Okay, so this is actually an entropy condition violating shock. It's a shock that moves into higher values of Q or higher pressure, and that is not physical. You always go from higher pressure to lower pressure, higher density to lower density. Yeah.
Is it the same F that we use there?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So what is the real solution? Well, it looks a little different than what we've been looking at so far. So at a later time, it looks like this. Okay, so it smooths out. And if you look at the characteristic structure, okay, so I drew these characteristics with negative slope. So we'll assume that the zero line is here. I messed up. Okay, it should have been just slightly positive. Okay, just so as to not confuse you. Okay, right. So I'll continue the negative slope thing, but typically you don't have like negative densities or pressures. So how about instead of this, we assume. I'm sorry. I hope I'm not destroying your notes. Let me just draw this better. Okay. So, sorry. All right. So this set of characteristics look like this up until you hit the. We call a rarefaction fan. So it's a self-similar solution where Q x of t is equal to QL for x less than QL of t, and the rarefaction state is x over t for x for QLt less than x less than QRt. It's the right state for Q greater than QRT. Okay, so it's just the solution is the left state and the right state bordering this continuous transition called the rarefaction fan. So the rarefaction fan is something that decreases density or pressure, you know, decreases Q. Okay. It's rarefying. Not a very common word, but that's where it comes from. So essentially, this is our general solution, general equation, is a set of these conservation laws that are coupled. Okay, so we have to solve this Riemann problem for each equation, and you know, since it's nonlinear, they're all combined, so we usually have to diagonalize it, etc., and then we have a set of Riemann solutions. So we have a set of Q at this cell boundary. Okay, so I destroyed it, but so let's say if this cell boundary was here, then we would know how Q evolved at that boundary now, right? Because we would have these solutions. So knowing that value of Q for some small interval in time, then we can perform the time average of the flux. Okay. So that's how we calculate the numerical flux, is by solving the Riemann problem at each cell interface. So if you see, here, let me draw that diagram again. So we had a sequence of cells and at different Qs. And so here we would see that this shock would move this way a little bit, and that shock would expand out that way, and it would go that way. Well, for Berger's equation, actually, this would turn into a rarefaction fan, right? Sorry. But these shocks would propagate that way. So at a later time, it would look, you know, something like this. So we could then integrate Q, or implicitly Q through integrating F, and derive F, and then update Q. Okay, but we can this since it's nonlinear. These speeds, so we know Berger's equations, that shock speed changes as Q changes. So we can only do this trick for a short interval of time. And so, well, however, solving the Riemann problem in general is very time consuming, okay? You have a set of six equations that are nonlinear and you need to solve them. It ends up becoming very difficult. Sometimes you can't find an exact solution because it's just too intractable. So, and remember, we're doing this for every cell. We're doing this twice per dimension at every cell. So if we have a lot of cells, then it's going to take a long time to solve this problem, to just do one time step. So this isn't an efficient way. So what we do is we use an approximate Riemann solver. Okay. And the Riemann solver that we'll be using is called the Rho solver. And this Rho solver, it's been around for almost 30 years, but people still use it in modern codes, works really well, and there's been a lot of work analyzing the method. So what you essentially do is you take your conservation law, remember, you know, dq dt plus df dx, and you approximate it with a quasi-linear system. So in general, remember Q is a vector, so A would be, in general, a matrix. Okay. So you approximate, so let me just write down the conservation equation. I'll ignore psi for now, okay? So you can see that maybe A should resemble df dq, right, the Jacobian of F. But Rho's method doesn't outright say that. It says that A has to satisfy these criteria. So it has to be a function of Q, L, and QR. And this matrix times QR minus QL should be equal to the difference of the right and left fluxes. Okay, so this is because, well, it should have the same shock speed. If there's a discontinuity there, it should result in the same shock propagating, you know, to the right or left. So looking at the Rankine-Hugoniot relationships, you know that then if if A satisfies this, then it satisfies the same Rankine-Hugoniot relationship that F did. Okay? Does that make sense? A needs to be diagonalizable. And have real eigenvalues. Okay. That just satisfies the hyperbolicity constraint. You know, the equation needs to maintain its hyperbolicity, which is good. And A needs to go to DFDQ smoothly as QL and QR go to some go to the cell average value. Okay, that just means that if you have a smooth function, then it should remain smooth after this approximate Riemann solution. And typically, what we use for A is simply the Jacobian evaluated at Q equal half of QL plus QR, or the average of the left and right state. So we calculate the average of the left and right state. We stick that into A, find the eigenvalues and the right eigenvectors. And we get this numerical flux equation, which I won't derive, but we'll just write down. And I'll point you to Levesque's book or notes for an explanation, or Rowe's original paper. Those references are given in the class notes online. And so the numerical flux equation for Rowe one half times the quantity. So the original flux QR so this part up to here is just an average of the left and right flux. So from 3, we know that whatever I'm about to write here should vanish as QL becomes QR. Okay. Okay. So also remember that, sorry, instead of an arrow, I'll put a line here. So these are all vectors. And this is the right eigenvector of A. Lambda are the eigenvalues of A, and omega are called the jumps. Okay, they're the they come from the Rankine-Hugoniot relationship. So it's you have to solve for them using this equation. So you can interpret omega as the jumps and the characteristic formulation of the equations. So what we're doing here is The right eigenvectors are allowing us to transform back from the diagonalized system. So, and then we compare then the non-diagonalized system to the original system, which is non-diagonalized. So lambda are the characteristic speeds in this diagonalized system. And given the diagonalized, the matrix that diagonalizes the system, we can diagonalize this system. We could solve for the characteristic variables. Maybe, we call them V. So if we diagonalize the system, we would have a equation. Like so, where lambda here is just a diagonal matrix of the eigenvalues. Okay. And so, okay, so we got almost all the ingredients except how to calculate the left and right state. Okay, so we assumed that, I've been kind of assuming that the left and right state were just the left-hand side of the discontinuity, and the right state was the right-hand side. But we can improve this a little bit. We can actually, instead of piecewise constant data, we can look at piecewise linear data. Okay, so instead of we still have the Q bars set up. But what we do know is we interpolate to the boundaries to get more accurate data. Okay, so if we were to just use a piecewise constant data, the spatial differencing would be first order accurate. Okay, we typically want to shoot for second order accuracy. I'm trying to think of a good reason why. I mean, you typically have shocks in these systems, so they end up reverting down to first order accuracy. In some solutions, second order accuracy gives you qualitatively different results given the same resolution. So people tend to, and also it amounts to a minimal amount of effort in coding. So it's usually advantageous to just use the second order equations. So what we do is we essentially kind of connect these up through linear functions. So here this is kind of easy because it's just a general trend upward. Here this is a little trickier. Do we keep on going up, or do we flatten it out, or do we go down to match this side? So depending upon the algorithm, typically we'd want to keep it flat, because if we went up more, we would steepen this discontinuity, which would add energy essentially into the problem. We don't want to do that. We want to keep things nice and quiet and stable. Okay, so we'll just keep it flat. This one we'll also connect it down. Okay, so this process that I just illustrated is called a slope limiting process. Okay, so not slope limiting would be something like this or like this. Okay, you don't really see the slope limiting process here. Or on the right-hand side, but you see it here. You tend to use the smallest slopes that you would choose from. Okay, you look at your neighbors, you examine the slopes you have, and then you choose the smallest one. So, in other words, so this is how you would actually implement this. So this is the left state at the I plus 1/2 interface. This is the cell center value plus some sigma, this is the slope, times the, you know, the difference in x. In the right-hand state at this interface, just slightly shifted, so it's more in the perspective of the neighboring cell. And sigma, sigma I, is the slope limiter, and there are also just like there are different approximate Riemann solvers, there are different slope limiters. Slope limiters, of course, are not as sophisticated as approximate Riemann solvers, but one example of a slope limiter is the min mod function. So S I plus 1/2 is one of the slopes. It's a, you know, just the gradient of the function. And this this operation is defined of A and B, it's defined as 0 if the slopes change in sign, okay, it's A if A is smaller than B in magnitude and they have both the same sign, and it's B if B is smaller in magnitude and they both have the same sign. So it just chooses the absolute value, absolute minimum of the slopes, and if there's a change in the slopes, then it just sets it to 0, flattens out the curve. And the notes wrote this all out in terms of p. Okay, p are called the primitive variables, and we haven't really introduced this concept yet, but there are conserved variables and primitive variables. Conserved variables are the ones that are, you know, the q's in the conservation law equations. They're the conserved density quantities. And the primitives are things that we typically think of. These are typically fluid frame quantities like the pressure, density, velocity. So these are all primitive variables, and Q are typically like T mu nu components, rho U mu. So in practice, what we usually do is, okay, so I'm sorry. So Q is a function of P, and this is, we know this, it's easy to derive. The inverse is complicated. Okay, so if you know Q, you need to solve this nonlinear algebraic equation to find P. But you just need to plug in P into the Q equations to get Q. So people tend to do the reconstruction process using P. One, because it's simpler, it requires fewer inversions, and two, it actually it doesn't, may not require fewer inversions. Let me think about that. But primarily, they do it because it's stabler. It leads to fewer numerical instabilities usually. And you can also, you can exploit your physical intuition more by fudging the primitive variables more than you can the conserved variables. So you know that, for instance, the pressure can't be negative, the density can't be negative, and so if you get a negative pressure density state, you should fix that up. Okay. So typically what you'd be doing in the project 2 numerical problem, you would be doing the slope limiting in terms of the primitive variables p, and all those slope limiting. You'd calculate q then. You would calculate pr and pl. You'd then calculate qr and ql from those pr and pls, and then go through this whole procedure after you've done the reconstruction. Okay. Any questions? I think we're about done for today. But in field, some questions. Straightforward. A little confusing. No.
Is the concept of those P's explained anywhere in the notes? Like I wrote it down. It's not defined at least.
Yeah, in the notes on page 8, they're first introduced, and they just kind of say, oh, you usually do things in terms of the primitive variables. And then on page 11, though, they're defined in terms of a physics example. So the rho and velocity, they cite as the primitive variables. And tau and s are the conserved variables. Those are just components of the stress energy tensor. There are people who have solved these equations as PDs in terms of the primitive variables, but those aren't typically very successful. I'm not actually, I just remember seeing this example when I was a grad student. I don't think any modern technique uses that prescription. That the PDs are actually more complicated. Because you imagine you have to carry out those derivatives through Q now. And it becomes a lot messier. And you no longer get conservation form, of course. Okay. Okay, thanks.